This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Michael Pavlich.
Michael Flood is the Associate Professor in Sociology at the University of Wollongong. Good morning, Michael.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And yourself?
Well, thank you. Slightly sleepy, but there you go.
Oh, right, you'll be okay. Tough bloke like you. Are men different these days than how they were? Is it just a psychological thing, or is there actually sort of some physical differences as well?
Look, there's all those things. So, I mean, I think we live in really interesting times in terms of what it means to be a man. And, you know, probably the best example of that is to do with fathering. You know, the images of what it means to be a father have changed radically. That, you know, to be a father used to be to, you know, sort of sit in the corner with your pipe and slippers, occasionally doling out some discipline to your kids, and really to be the kind of stern disciplinarian. Whereas these days, to be a dad is to, you know, get in there, to change nappies, to play with kids, to be sort of emotionally and physically involved. And there's been a really radical change in that dimension of men's lives, at least in terms of the imagery of being a father. Now, men's actual behaviour has shifted more slowly, and there's real constraints on being an involved dad in various ways. But, you know, I think that's one good example of how there have been some really important shifts in, you know, what it means to be a man in Australian society.
You mentioned the image aspect of it there. It does seem there is this very big shift in the image. We see a lot in film and television these days of the men almost painted as a bit of a fool. You know, the dad figure is almost a little bit of a fool, whereas in the old days he was much more rugged and masculine and shooting guns and stuff. But in sitcoms and in films, certainly that image of a dad being a bit of a klutz, all the dad jokes, that sort of stuff, there's a bit of a soft edge has crept into dad's image or the men's image.
There is, and look, I mean, I think there's a kind of friendly side to that and, a sort of a less friendly side to that. So, you know, certainly one image of men in popular culture these days is the kind of infantilized man, the man who's, you know, 30 but, you know, hasn't left home, hasn't grown up, is still a virgin, is still kind of, you know, bumbling with women and so on. And I think there's, you know, I think that represents a kind of slight unease about where men's roles are going. But there's lots of, you know, positive or, you know, neutral images of men as well. So look around and our, you know, our culture routinely highlights, you know, men's achievements, whether as sports players or politicians or businessmen. And so there's lots of ways in which men are still shown as the, you know, the kind of leaders and doers and decision makers and important people in our world. That's shifting too, so that, you know, there's slightly more visibility for women's achievements, women's sport, and so on. But I think there are some interesting shifts, and, you know, there's sort of a real unevenness here. So, for example, we know among young men there's been a significant shift towards gender equality. Young men these days are more likely than older generations of men to think that women and men should be equal in relationships, more likely to reject the belief that, women want men to be dominant in relationships. They haven't caught up to young women, though. There's still a gender gap, and that's true for all sorts of attitudes, whether it's fathering or pornography or violence or anything. There's a gender gap where men's attitudes tend not to be as progressive as women's, but certainly younger men's attitudes are better than those of older men. And you see that shift particularly, say, around violence, also around emotions. There's some signs, for example, that young men are able to have more emotionally expressive friendships with their mates than older men, more likely to be face-to-face rather than side-by-side. You know, the traditional model of male friendships is of side-by-side friendships where you do things together, whereas there's slightly more room these days, I think, for men to actually, you know, face each other, to talk about their feelings, talk about relationships, talk about other kinds of things that were seen as kind of stereotypically feminine. So again, you know, that's an example of a shift. So I'm not wanting to get too kind of rosy-eyed about this. There are some significant gender inequalities that haven't gone away at all. And in fact, if we look at things like women's and men's participation in economic life or women's and men's roles as decision makers, there's been virtually no change in a decade, for example, in the numbers of women in corporate boardrooms or the numbers of women in parliament. But there's other ways in which there have been important shifts.
In talking about those jobs there, because the career is something that in the past, like up to 100 years ago, if a man was born into a family, he would be expected to follow in his dad's career footsteps. You know, all the businesses were such and such and sons. It was pretty much a demarcation, I suppose. You pretty much went and worked for your father, and that was all you knew. With the changing roles of the workplace, with a lot of people going off the land and changing shape of I suppose, the corporate world, that a lot of those careers and a lot of those that lineage disappeared. Has that been a bit of an issue for modern men to come to terms with a life that isn't perhaps as well mapped out as it was in the past?
Look, I think it is certainly, you know, work is, I think, a place where you can see a kind of crisis. You can see a kind of crisis among some men. It's less about the fact that they're not going to have a lifelong career anymore and they're going to have to make substantial career changes. And I think instead it's about something else. And what it's about for many men is that one traditional area of male work, which is industrial work, you know, sort of building things, making things, manufacturing, primary industry and so on, is declining in Australia. So large numbers of blue-collar men or working-class men are having to reskill, having to retrain or being, you know, retrenched or sacked. And I'm at a university which is right next to a major industrial centre, the Port Kembla Steelworks, and that's been, you know, laying off people, and the people it's laying off are largely men, are largely blue-collar and working class men. And it's that kind of shift in industry which is prompting, you know, sort of magazine covers saying there's a crisis among men or it's the end of men, that kind of thing, because certainly for men in those kinds of jobs I think there's been a real shift. And what we've seen in work and industry is some level of women moving into previously masculine professions in law, in accounting, in other, you know, in engineering and so on, but there's been far less move of men into feminine professions. The numbers of men who are primary school teachers or nurses and so on has really not gone up much at all in Australia. And so still in the workplace there's this kind of devaluing or sort of lesser status given to stereotypically feminine work, to caring work, to nurturing work and so on. And probably because of that, not many men are moving into that. But at the same time, lots of men are losing jobs, you know, in the industry and so on. And that's prompting a crisis, particularly because one of the main definitions of being a man that's still around in Australia is to be a man is to bring home the bacon, is to, you know, be the breadwinner. And so if you're a bloke who can no longer do that, who's lost your job and, you know, your wife's in paid work, that I think can be very personally challenging for some men.
I think also, because you see quite a few stay-home dads these days, and it's a role that, you know, I mean, it sits comfortably with the blokes I know who are doing it, but I know it's something that they do suffer a little bit of stigma for.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, there's two things that go on. On the one hand, you know, there is stigma. I think, you know, men who do become the primary carers, the stay-home dads for their kids, they still experience stigma at work and they experience some of the, you know, real difficulties of balancing work and family life that women routinely encounter. So they get stigma on the one hand, and particularly among male peers, it may be seen as a kind of failure of their career, you know, putting aside of or abandoning of their career. And on the other hand, they're also lauded with praise. They're also you know, sort of given excessive praise. Isn't it wonderful to see a man caring for his children? And kind of, in some ways, we actually set the bar very low for what it means to be an involved father. But yeah, no doubt, lots of men, particularly men in, you know, who are in full-time paid work, really struggle to then become involved parents. And that's one of the key constraints on involved fathering, is we still have a work culture that is, you know, very materialistic, that is terrible at supporting parents of either sex in being involved with their children.
What about the role there? We're talking about stay-at-home dads, but there's also the role, even for working dads and working men, the role at home has changed quite a bit. In the old days, dad would get home late, probably be working late. He'd get home and have his dinner served up for him and wouldn't, you know, have a lot of interaction with the kids. These days, there's a lot more hands-on, that dad is much more part of the family activity, the family dinner table activity.
Yeah, that's true. And look, I experienced that for myself. I've got two young kids and, you know, I just couldn't get away these days, I think, with, you know, having no involvement in their everyday care or in the cooking or the organisation of, you know, school uniforms and lunches and so on. And, you know, my partner is in full-time paid work herself. And so, you know, I think I'm kind of living what's, you know, an increasingly kind of modern arrangement where men and women try to share the care of children and try to share, you know, exactly that kind of involvement in the sort of everyday, you know, organisation of children's lives. And, you know, it's no doubt it's hard work and also, you know, richly rewarding work. You know, having said that, again, you know, the shifts are uneven and, you know, there's still a really significant gap in hours spent each week in caring and domestic work. And that's true even of couples where both, you know, both people are in full-time paid work, where in general men tend to do less than women. The gap's closed a little, and the gap's closed a little in the last decade, partly because women are doing less, because women in paid work are also now paying others to care for children or to prepare meals and so on, or they're just doing less domestic work, full stop. And so, you know, I think our fathering is an interesting example where our images of what it means to be a father have changed really rapidly in two decades, but the actual practice of fathering has shifted much more slowly. And I think it's done so for kind of understandable reasons, as I said, kind of work constraints and other kinds of institutional constraints.
You talked there a little bit about the home life and how both parents, you know, may be in jobs these days. I mean, that in itself is something that's very different to how it was 50 years ago when there was usually only one breadwinner in the house. Now that there's two, there's less time to do things like be parents and to have dinner with the family. So, it's a positive shift. You'd think that men actually have more time on their hands.
No, that's true, although I think time poverty, you know, sort of a lack of time, feeling pressed, feeling busy is increasingly chronic too. So that doesn't help. And we, as you know, have some of the longest kind of working hours in the Western world. But I think that is productive. And I mean, there's many ways in which, you know, just to take a step back, sort of thinking about when men and where men are at, you know, some newspaper articles and elsewhere kind of proclaim men are in crisis. But in fact, I look around among men and women in Australia and I see men flourishing. I see men really enjoying the kind of opening up of gender roles that I think feminism and the women's movement have prompted. So men enjoying, for example, being involved fathers, men enjoying having closer and more intimate friendships with other men and indeed with women, men enjoying having more trusting and honest and equitable relationships with wives and girlfriends. So there's lots of ways in which these shifts have actually opened up what it means to be a man. So it's more possible to be an involved father, to be a friend who can support your mate when, you know, his wife's left him or is going through a hard time or a health crisis or something. But all sorts of ways in which this has been really positive for men. Having said that, you know, there's some ways in which our culture is also shifting in, I think, probably more negative ways. I've been doing some research, for example, on pornography, and I think that pornography is an increasingly sort of negative influence on young men's attitudes towards sex and relationships and is shaping a kind of increasingly kind of sleazy and coercive view of women among young men. And it's hard to tell whether that's increasing or not, because young men also show, you know, significant support for gender equality, as I said. But I think there's some influences, you know, one I've mentioned is pornography, that also are pushing back and actually going in the opposite direction.
I mean, there's been quite a lot of that over the years. I mean, men have always been a little bit interested in girly magazines and stuff. I mean, how's it different now?
Look, it's different now because exposure to pornography is much more pervasive. It's at younger ages, and probably what's most important is the material's different. It's no longer, you know, pictures or images of a woman, you know, posing half naked or naked. It's images of explicit sex, and the problem there is not the sex. The problem there is that often that sex is aggressive or coercive or hostile, and so women are shown being brutalized or being treated in really hostile and derogatory ways, and so the content of pornography has shifted too. So yeah, I agree, men have looked at, you know, magazines, and 15-year-olds have found the porno under their dad's beds for, you know, for generations. But what's shifted is the extent of exposure and what young men themselves are actually looking at. And so I think that is having some level of kind of dangerous influence.
All right. What about the Australian male? Because traditionally, you know, Australian men have been painted as pretty sort of gruff, tough, rough men, Has the image or the archetype of the Australian male, is that undergoing a transformation?
That's a really good question. I think it is. It has to be. It has to be, given all the shifts in gender roles and gender relations I've described. Having said that, we've got really poor data. It's actually quite hard to tell how images of masculinity in Australia have shifted. There's some really good research. I'm at a conference on gender studies at the moment in Brisbane, and there's some really interesting postgraduate and other research that they're talking, for example, about images of men in movies and TV in Australia. But there's still some very powerful archetypes of the, you know, the Anzac or the farmer or the lifesaver or so on, which kind of do shape Australian perceptions. And, you know, if the recent Prime Minister Howard can suggest that mateship should be embedded in, in the Constitution, then that tells you that some very traditional ideas of what it means to be a man are still around. But, you know, walk down any street in any major city and you'll also see men living and acting in ways which look pretty different from that, or which are kind of contradictory in that sense. So hipsters, for example, I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of hipsters, who kind of show this kind of nostalgia for a kind of tr- traditional or archaic masculinity, you know, get into obscure forms of whiskey and lots of facial hair and so on. And, you know, there's some really odd and interesting things going on among men, whether it's hipsters or lumbersexuals or metrosexuals.
Well,
or
what's a lumbersexual?
So, these terms sometimes are made up by journalists, but they do pick up on genuine trends among
men. What is a
lumbersexual?
But
the lumbersexual, again, is someone who, you know, adopts this kind of interest in... in kind of survival, in, you know, being able to live in the woods, being able to, you know, sort of grow their own food, but also, in a sense, it's a rougher masculinity, but it's also cultivated and involves an appreciation of certain kinds of, I don't know, food or coffee or whatever. So, you know, another term that's out there is the spornosexual, and the spornosexual is the bloke who is obsessed with his own body and his own muscles, might be a kind of sports player or athlete, but is also into kind of casual sex and very much into getting girls and so on. And so, you know, none of this language really picks up on this stuff very well. And, of course, as soon as you invent a stereotype, men jump out of it. But I think there are some interesting and contradictory things going on among men.
Yeah, I was thinking of when you said a couple of those things about that, the fellow who was banned from coming to Australia, who runs an online site or a Facebook page, like extreme masculine. Yeah, well, it's pick-up artist.
Yeah, so pickup artists are interesting too, and
the reactionary thing, do you think?
Look, it is. It comes often out of a kind of frustration, I think, that some men feel at what they feel. I think wrongly is a kind of unequal, you know, dating market where, you know, women hold all the cards, and so what they try to do through pickup artist workshops and books and so on is to kind of skill themselves in more effective ways to, you know, find casual sex or find a partner. And what's troubling about the pickup artist scene is that the skills they're learning are often skills in manipulating women or making women feel bad about their appearance or themselves so that they're more vulnerable to these men's attentions. And that seems to me a disaster. You know, if you're interested in having casual sex or interested in having a relationship, I think the last thing you want to do is to be trying to practice manipulating and coercing the women to whom you're attracted. That's just going to lead to, you know, some terrible and toxic relationships, if not to violence. So
it's a power thing, really. I mean, it's quite apparent that it's a power thing. And do you think, though, that's come about because these men feel emasculated or demasculated, if you like?
Look, I think that's part of it. It is a kind of backlash. And, you know, you can also see that backlash in some of the kind of men's groups or fathers' groups that are out there that very much see men now as the victims, see feminism as having taken over, and try to kind of advocate, if you like, for, you know, men's rights or fathers' rights. And again, I think they are responses to genuine shifts in men's lives and social conditions, but they're misguided responses. They attack the wrong targets and they adopt the wrong solutions. And certainly I would be delighted if there was a much more active conversation in Australian society about what it means to be a man and how we should be raising our boys. And we see little bits and pieces of that. And one of the things I notice, for example, is there's been much more attention to, you know, raising girls to be confident, to reach for the sky, to, you know, aspire to be prime ministers or astronauts or engineers. But we've done far less, I think, to think about opening up boundaries for our boys. You know, people are much more comfortable putting, you know, girls in pants than they are putting boys in dresses. Much more comfortable challenging stereotypical femininity than masculinity. So in a sense, I think we still put, you know, stereotypical masculinity, the qualities associated with being a man, above those associated with being a woman. So we're much more nervous about sissies than tomboys, for example.
There's also, you talk about to men's groups, I mean, there are a lot of positive men's groups. I'm thinking about all the men's sheds, or the men's shed movement. That's an example of older men talking to younger men and men getting together and talking about men's issues. There's also, historically, there's been things like the Lions Club and the Apex Club and Rotary, those sorts of things, which traditionally were men's clubs, and in many ways they were positive institutions as well.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And, you know, I think there can be incredibly, you know, incredible kind of power and value in men getting together to, you know, do things together or to, you know, share aspects of their lives together and so on. In fact, for me, I mean, one of the most transformative experiences for me was when I was about 20 and got involved in a men's group. And it wasn't a men's group focused on, you know, poor us, poor victims, nor was it a men's group focused on, you know, kind of beating drums or something. It was a men's group really wanting to talk about what it means to be a man and thinking about our relationships with our girlfriends and being a dad and our experiences of violence and so on. And for me, that was a really powerful way to, you know, I suppose, you know, to grow personally and to, you know, let go of some of the kind of narrow thinking which I think we still socialize boys into about how to be a man and how to live in the world. So yeah, men's groups I think are one valuable strategy, whether it's men's sheds or other kinds of spaces.
So you didn't have to put war paint on and sit in the bush.
No, I have seen such things. I've certainly been around some of the stuff, and, you know, maybe there's some value in it, but to me it seemed less useful than, you know, honest chats with other men, I suppose.
So very good morning, Kate.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Excellent. A very interesting discussion that you're having.
Oh, thanks.
It's interesting to me because for the past 2.5 years, my other half, well, we're not married, but I call him my husband anyway, we sort of swapped, and he's been stay-at-home dad for that time, and I went back to work. He was, you know, the traditional breadwinner before that. We had two little kids, and when the second baby was 8 months old, we just swapped, and I went back to work. I'm a lawyer, and he just did this huge shift, which was going from being a human resources manager in a big corporation to being a stay-at-home dad, and so this discussion is really interesting to me because it's been a really interesting experience, but a really good one, I think, as well.
How's he finding it?
Well, he very quickly after taking over, he found out that it actually wasn't as easy as he thought it would be. But he has found it both difficult and, I think, very rewarding. Like, the relationship that he has with our two kids now is really quite something because they see him as probably the primary carer. He always says that. I'm the primary carer now, so as a joke. But they do see him in that really nurturing role, and I think that's fantastic. I'm always interested in hearing discussions about what it is to be a man nowadays and all that sort of thing because I think about it all the time. I worry about it so much. But also, I think that in our experience, it's just been way more positive than negative, I think.
I'm not surprised that you've taken on the primary career role. Lawyers get paid pretty well. He's probably going to have a bit of trouble matching your salary there. But what about for you? As a mum, was it hard for you to leave the nest early and leave the kids at home when you thought you should have been at home still?
Really, really hard. And I sometimes wonder if I did it too soon. Obviously, so my daughter was still 8 months old and she was still a baby. I'm lucky that I can be flexible in my work hours, so I was around probably, I tried to be around as much as I could, but yes, I found it incredibly difficult. But I also made a decision, I did a lot of reading about it, and I made a decision that I had to let my other half do the job on his own and not try and tell him what to do, that I had to just let him take over the reins and trust him to do that. And that's, I mean, that was kind of hard, but I think that's the key, really, to not... You were talking before about men being portrayed as infantile and that sort of thing, and I think it's important not to do that because even though men have... I think he has a different way of doing it than what I would, but I've just let him do that.
Do you still find yourself doing lots of washing and dishes on the weekend?
No, because... No, I don't, because I've really never been very good at that anyway.
Right. He sounds like a beaut, your husband.
Oh, he's really amazing, and he's actually retraining to become a primary school teacher at the same time.
Can't get enough of him.
I know, so how cool is that?
That's great.
Yeah, anyway, it's been good for us, but we're constantly kind of navigating that, the gender roles, and I feel more like the dad now, which is kind of weird.
That is weird. What's your husband's name?
Simon.
Great. Thank you, Kate, for your call. Very interesting points. We'll take them up with Michael.
Thanks.
Good on you. These are almost like a brave new world. They're almost like experimenting into, you know, how things may be for lots of families, lots more families in the future. But it sounds like it's working out okay for them, Michael.
It doesn't. I mean, look, that story just really made me smile. I mean, you could really hear the kind of, you know, I think the kind of joy and love in the, you know, this couple working out a different way of doing things and, you know, the ways in which it's been enormously beneficial for them both and the ways in which it's challenging because it, you know, maybe, you know, draws on, you know, skills or ways of being that, you know, neither of them are very used to, where Kate's had to, you know, in some ways let go of her role as a kind of primary caregiver and where Simon, her partner's, you know, sort of learning new skills and so on. But, you know, I think that's a perfect example of the ways in which these shifts in gender roles, you know, do open up opportunities for both women and men.
You get a sense that Simon's quite enjoying being a dad in amongst
Indeed.
All that.
Indeed. And look, you know, that all the research evidence tells us that men are just as capable as women of being, you know, nurturing, involved parents. Give them the chance to do so, and they, you know, they learn those skills just as women do.
G'day, Ace. Oh, Ace, you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what did you want to say?
Well, I've been opening my doors. Oh, g'day, Dennis in Sydney, by the way.
G'day, Dennis in Sydney.
I've been opening my doors to a couple of mates who have had relationship finishes after a number of years, and also deaths in the family that they've had. And my brother, unfortunately, Al, died last year. And so I've opened my door to make sure I've had a bit of a men's shed so they can talk about it, because the expectation of so many blokes now, we're living in a society of consumer want. We want everything. We're a consumerist deservism society. And I think, like magazines had done maybe a generation ago with most of the women who had looked at the want of what they need to be, men have now looked at social media and said, well, we can't keep up with this. And they're actually looked at expectations that society's putting upon them, and they're questioning so many different things, and I think blokes are really getting rather confused. And I don't think that we're now, the stigma that we had with men's health, oh, just chip up, boy, there, you'll be right. No, let's talk about the fact that you've got a bit of an issue, mate. How are things going? Hmm. And that's really what some blokes need to be doing a little bit more of, and that's why the men's sheds, et cetera, were great. But I've even said, mate, stay over here tonight, don't have to drive home. Just make sure we have a chat about things, and it's been really good for these blokes. I can see them getting back on track and not being so down on themselves, and it's just really a good chat about things.
Hey, you bring up a couple of things there, Ace. That's a good call. Thank you for
Thanks,
sharing
mate.
It with
Talk
us.
To you soon.
Okay, catch you later. Men's health is an issue here, in a sense, Michael. That traditionally, men haven't been the best at coming forward and you know, checking out how well they are and or complaining about whether they're a bit crook or not. And as I said there, the men's sheds do provide an opportunity for men of different ages to get together and talk about the sort of issues that men face. And really, you can't be doing that with anybody else than other blokes.
That's true. And look at, you know, if we look at men's health, you know, and we look at, you know, why it is that men, you know, may not go to the doctor or may not take the doctor's advice, or why men take risks, for example, whether it's, you know, at work or, you know, in driving cars and so on. You know, we realize that masculinity is, you know, is central to the issue, that traditionally men are taught that we should be, you know, 10 feet tall and, you know, bulletproof. And we're taught that we should treat ourselves as invulnerable and strong. We shouldn't show weakness and so on. And that then has a disastrous impact on our physical health and, as Dennis said, on our emotional health too. And it can mean that, you know, we neglect our friendships or relationships, and can mean that we're stuffed if, you know, if a relationship breaks down, or, you know, a partner dies, or, you know, any of those kind of profound experiences of grief and trauma. So I think the work on men's health that's happened over the last few decades has named traditional masculinity as something we need to change. We need to open up room for men to be able to seek help, to admit weakness, to show vulnerable emotions. And, you know, I think that too is very positive, and I think, you know, also very challenging for generations of men.
I read an interesting book a few years back called Iron John by an author called Robert Bly. It looked a little bit about the mythology of masculinity, and it was quite interesting because there are different archetypes, I suppose you could only call them, of masculinity. For example, the warrior, you mentioned about how we're meant to be 10 foot tall and bulletproof. That's very much the warrior sort of archetype. And then, but beyond that, the king archetype is another one, that where a man is fully in charge of his faculties and uses a bit of guile, is very eloquent. There are a number of facets to masculinity that have been quite well illustrated in the great myths of time.
Yeah, look, I mean, what Robert Bly in that book Iron John gets right is that there are, you know, different ways of being a man, different kind of archetypes and so on. I think what he gets wrong is he, you know, he sort of fails to recognise that those ideas about being a man change. They change across history, they change across culture, and if I recall the book correctly, he ends up kind of blaming women for some of the woes that men face, and says the main way to heal and help men is really to, you know, initiate men into manhood through other men. And I think, you know, there's some real limits on that solution. But, you know, he's right to point to, I think, some diverse ideals of what it means to be a man. And certainly if we look around Australian society, we see, you know, across Australia's multicultural communities and across different generations and across gay and straight and so on, you see a kind of radical diversity in ideas about, you know, how men should behave and how men should, you know, treat other women and so on. And that's shifting. I mean, I think the debates about same-sex marriage are a perfect example of how our ideas about gender and sexuality are shifting. Likewise, there seems to be much greater comfort, for example, about homosexuality among young men. Young heterosexual men these days are much more comfortable with gay friends, less likely to be openly homophobic themselves, have high levels of support for same-sex marriage and so on. And that's a radical change, because masculinity traditionally was defined in terms of being not feminine and not gay. And the most frequent insult, certainly for me growing up at school and for lots of men, and the most frequent insult when you step out of traditional masculinity is, you know, are you a poof, are you gay, are you a faggot, and so on. The second set of insults, of course, are, you know, pansy and feminine and
sissy
and so on.
You're a girl. You get called a girl, and that's meant
exactly.
to be a derogatory
term. There's all sorts
term.
Of ways in which we still police masculinity. We try to keep men and boys inside the man box, for want of a better term. But that's shifting. It's breaking down, I think, in some valuable ways.
A couple of texts in. Nana Tracker says, very few young blokes these days have any work ethic, no heart for hard work.
Interesting.
That's an observation. Also got this one. Men enjoy being active in their children's lives until the courts say they can't. And we get a lot of calls here from disgruntled dads who can't get custody, who feel they've been not looked after by the courts. Does our legislature look after men enough, do you think?
Look, I don't think the problem is the courts. I don't think the problem is our legislation. In fact, these days, you know, there's an emphasis in family law on children's right to have contact with both parents, and a kind of presumption that both parents will be involved in their care. There's not a presumption that children will live 50% of the time with each parent, and I think that would be dangerous and, in fact, impractical for many separating parents. But there is certainly an emphasis on parents' involvement. The bigger obstacles to separated dads' involvements with children after separation is lack of involvement before separation. I don't mean here men are lazy or men haven't bothered. It's that we have a society that in all sorts of ways makes it hard for men to be involved parents. And so most couples, most heterosexual couples, the men do less parenting, far less likely to be the primary caregiver than women, despite examples like Kate and Simon earlier. And so when it comes to separation and divorce, courts typically reproduce those patterns. They say, well, you know, she was the primary caregiver before separation, so she'll be the primary caregiver after separation. And that's actually what most couples themselves decide. It's not what the court imposes. Most couples themselves decide that. And one of the reasons many couples, separating couples, decide that is because of wage inequalities. In general, in society, men are paid more than women because of the kinds of jobs they do and the typical career paths they have. And so lots of couples make pragmatic decisions that, you know, she'll stay home or she'll go part-time and he'll work full-time. And so that means after separation, that pattern continues. So if we really want to increase fathers' involvement with kids after separation, we have to increase fathers' involvement with kids before separation. Okay. And that means tackling gender inequalities in paid work. It means good parental leave. It means shifting the assumptions where, you know, we shouldn't give boys dolls. God forbid a boy would play with a doll, but somehow when he's a dad, he's expected to be an involved father.
I don't know. I had a G.I. Joe when I was a kid. Hey, listen, we've got a full board of calls here, Michael, so we're trying to squeeze as many in as
sure.
we can. Hey, good morning, Kerry.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks.
I think that men now are a lot better. I'm one of the older generations, and he was talking about pornography and all that. It was worse, it was rife in the olden days, whereas nowadays it's no different. It's just a lot better. I find that men are a lot better nowadays than they were. If they wanted to be involved with their children in the olden days, they just didn't bother.
Yeah, there's no doubt there's been a shift, but the internet and pornography, Kerry, I think has almost taken that to a new level. Let's have a chat to Ray. G'day, Ray. Thank you, Kerry, for your call. Ray, g'day.
Yeah, I know I've got to be quick. Basically, during my lifetime, I've known two different car clubs. Should I name them? Because I'm not going to say anything bad about them.
By all means.
Yeah, one's the Toyota Club and the other is the Wolseley Club. Now, they're both lovely people, but the big difference is the Wolseley people about 30 years ago decided they needed spares for their old cars. The Toyota people have never thought about that, and it's getting a bit late now, and they've got a few old cars. The Wolseley people decided to collect spares, and they've got this huge truck shed way out near wherever in the northeast suburbs. And this truck shed not only stores the parts, but they've got a huge tea room in it and so forth.
So there's a couple of men's groups that you're involved with, Ray.
But Yeah, they're men's groups, basically, but women are welcome to either of them. We don't have many women in the Wolseley Club, but we have quite a lot in the Toyota Club. And one little thing, I'd better finish on this. About 5 years ago, the rumour was spreading that there was one particular urologist that used to damage people, all the tests they do for prostate cancer, and the word began to spread. Well, we very carefully put that word out as a warning to a lot of people. So we get to talk about things sometimes in considerable detail. It's very useful.
All right, some good points there that Ray's made, Michael.
Yeah, look, indeed, I wanted to go back to Kerry. Kerry said it was worse in the olden days, and I think she's probably right, that there's all sorts of ways now where men are expected to be, expected to treat women well, that I think are historically new. And another part of that is, an opening up of men's own roles in terms of being dads, being more intimate and caring mates, being good husbands and so on. So, maybe it's just my optimistic nature, but I think we're living in positive times in terms of some really productive shifts in gender roles.
See, I've got a text here from Richard that says, it feels like all discussions on men are being driven by feminists, this one included. Probably a fair comment. I mean, everyone's calling themselves a feminist these days. I think Alan Jones was on television the other day saying he was a feminist.
So. Seems to set the bar very low for what it means to be a feminist. Yeah, look, I think feminism in general has been great for men, actually. It's certainly challenged some of the ugly things that a minority of men do. And
You've
at the same
go,
time,
Michael.
It said, let's open up what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman.
The news is coming up. Look, thank you for your time this morning.